But fear me not, I will do you no harm. Loan me your funky mind, and I shall play with it. For nothing is good unless you play with it. And all that is good is nasty.
Hey, everybody. It's the Dystopian Dance Party podcast. I'm Zach, and this is Kelly. And amazingly, we're back again in less than a month after the last podcast. Don't get used to this, because we're not going to be able to keep this momentum up. But we wanted to get back together and record again, because it's been a long time since we did a Dystopian Book Club podcast. Those are the ones that if people had to choose any of our stuff to listen to, it would be this.
Well, dude, that's either listening to these or putting your balls in a blender. So choice is yours.
Yeah. One of our YouTube commenters recently said they would rather put their balls in a blender than listen. So they either hate us or hate their balls. I don't know which, but
Well, if you do put your balls in a blender, please record it and upload it. I'll put the audio on YouTube, and we'll decide then which one gets the more listeners.
It works out because we love to listen to people blend their balls. So
yeah, it's a trade.
Yeah. Obviously, Dystopian Book Club started with the KISS autobiographies. We did those four. And then we kind of took a detour and did Rick James, and that felt like sort of a departure, but sort of not a departure, because Rick James is kind of like, he's like the rock star of funk, you know? So it still felt like we were kind of still in our wheelhouse of like trashy rock biographies, because that's kind of how I think about Dystopian Book Club. I think we've talked about this before. I personally would love to read Elvis Costello's autobiography, but I would never say Dystopian Book Club needs to do Elvis Costello's autobiography, because that's like too smart, you know? There needs to be a certain level of like trashiness to it.
Although we did Mark Bolan's not autobiography, but biography.
Yeah.
There was a lot of cocaine in it at a certain point. It was like an actual smart book, whereas Rick James' trashy book and the Four KISS autobiographies are not.
Yeah, it's like there's at some point, maybe I'll figure out like a precise formula, because there does have to be, it either needs to be, you know, very trashy, or there needs to be like a certain amount of cocaine use, I think, is honestly a big part of it. Because Mark Bolan, that was a good book. And I would even say the book that we're talking about today, which is, of course, Brothers Be You Like George, Ain't That Funkin' Kinda Hard on You by George Clinton, the founder of Parliament Funkadelic. You know, this is a proper book that you wouldn't be embarrassed to read on a train or something. It's not the dirt, you know.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be embarrassed, but the image on the cover is so stupid to me, because it just. I feel the same way to a certain extent about Grace Jones's autobiography, which I recently read, which is like, it's such like a basic like album cover for someone. Like, I wish the album or the book cover was more interesting. You know what I mean? Like, instead, it's just like a glamour shot.
Yeah, I just looked up the Grace Jones book, and it does look, it looks kind of like a magazine cover.
Yeah, exactly. And I just like, I like, she has so many cool pictures of her. Like, why is it just that image? It just, it looks like somebody's aunt.
Right.
And like George Clinton's is kind of the same thing. It's just like a white background with him in his hat, and he's like kind of like side eyeing the camera.
Yeah.
I'm just not a fan. And then, like, I don't know. I just feel like, especially given how much iconic imagery of George Clinton exists, like Grace Jones.
Right.
Even like cartoon depictions and stuff. Like, I get that it was probably like, you know, a cheap cover to just get the book out.
Right.
But it just kind of annoys me. Like, I just feel like it could have been more interesting.
I definitely agree with that. I do like, they've kind of got the Parliament font going on, which is, that's a cool touch. On the other hand, the other font looks like Comic Sans. So, you know, it's a real trade-off.
Right.
This actually makes me think, would we do Grace Jones' autobiography for Disney?
I want to.
My gut reaction would have been, I don't know if it fits, but I think we're broadening our horizons.
It technically doesn't fit. However, she does do drugs. But
okay,
like,
if there's cocaine, Grace Jones, all right.
Grace Jones is too smart, but I feel like George Clinton is too. So
George Clinton is also smart. Yeah, yeah.
We are broadening our horizon. But like, but I feel like Parliament Funkadelic did enough like goofy stuff that it kind of fits. But Grace Jones also did like, there are some like goofy Grace Jones stories. So
yeah.
I don't know. I feel like I've been wanting to do that one, and I did read it like a couple months ago. So
I do think we need more women. You know, we've really, yeah. it's been a sausage party for sure. So maybe that might be something to consider. Because I think at this point, you know, there needs to be a certain amount of cocaine use. There needs to be a certain amount of like stupid stories. But there aren't
that many women in rock music, and the women who are in rock music, I feel like, aren't that dumb.
Right.
Like that, fucking yeah. Kiss. Because I'm looking, the standard yeah. I'm looking
who's
for
the
is like
female
Kiss
equivalent
and
of
Lee
Kiss.
Roth.
Like Lita
who's the,
Ford.
Who's
maybe?
The
like...
female equivalent of David Lee Roth? Like, you couldn't get away with that as a woman, I don't
right.
feel like.
So, you know, so I think at some point we'll probably have to expand the definition even more, but for now this is familiar territory still, because we've on the one, you know, it's Rick James shows up in this book, Kiss shows up in this book, and Parliament is sort of like there's a lot of parallels between Parliament and Kiss. You know, they're both they were both signed to Casablanca Records,
both made up characters.
But really like out. Wearing like big tall boots.
Right. And like, they both pushed out like so much music within a short span of time at the same time. But right. I was thinking about this as I was reading it, like, and I think I mentioned this a little bit in the Kiss podcast we just recorded, that like Kiss pushed out so much music from 74 to what, like 80?
Yeah.
But it wasn't good.
Yeah.
Most of it was not good.
Yeah. You could tell by their third or even second album that they were already scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Right. Right. But Parliament Funkadelic, like, really, and that was like two bands,
right.
mostly comprised of the same people, but
right.
the amount of music that Parliament Funkadelic produced, and that's not even including like the Protégés and everything, mm-hmm. in this, like, from the late 60s to the early 80s, was pretty much, it seems like, twice as much music as Kiss made.
Yeah,
and it definitely was better quality.
Very, very consistent. Like, up, I mean, you know, Parliament and Funkadelic,
the 80s,
they
really.
Did run out of ideas, but I mean,
but
I think like, a lot of that was because they started doing crack.
Right. And not until they started doing heavy drugs and the 80s, which a
right.
lot of people kind of started faltering in the 80s. And then in the 80s, George Clinton went solo and had another like whole career.
Yeah. Like two and two or three of those albums are really good, you know, like,
yeah. And by then he was like pretty old at that point. So it's like, even considering that. So really, like, Parliament Funkadelic was consistently good for their whole career. Kiss,
yeah,
maybe pick out two or three good songs on every album.
Yeah, the one thing that I've really enjoyed about reading this book, you know, even apart from the book itself is good. You know, George Clinton is obviously a really like charismatic guy. He has, even though this book was ghostwritten, I actually that's a pet peeve of mine when people say ghost written, because he's not a ghost. His name's right on the front of the book. It was written with a guy named Ben Greenman, who is he's a fiction and nonfiction writer. I think he's probably best known for The New Yorker. He's written a couple of books with Questlove. He wrote a frankly pretty mediocre Prince book a couple of years ago, which I reviewed on my other podcast, my Prince-centric podcast. Between the two books, this one is much better. And I think a lot of that is because George Clinton's voice is just so witty and kind of wise. And he comes up with these turns of phrase that are very much like Parliament lyrics, you know? Yeah,
you understand where they came from.
Right, exactly.
By the like way that the book is written, which I think is... That's what made it interesting to read for me, because like he's a smart, interesting person, but also like a lot of what reading the book is like is almost like listening to a Parliament Funkadelic song, like in terms of the lyrics.
Right.
Which right. I think like that makes it much more interesting than if it had just been like, because I feel like even with the Rick James book, and not the original trashy one, that one sounds more like Rick James, but the Glow one, it's very like filtered and sounds more like music journalism.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that this book sounds very much like George Clinton's voice.
Yeah, his voice is really evident. And I don't know how George and Ben Greenman wrote this. My guess is that there were a lot of interviews that Greenman probably recorded, you know, and basically transcribed and then kind of gave them shape and clarity and all of that stuff. But it never really feels like there's a middleman. You know, it feels like I very literally read this book in his voice, which is not as unpleasant as when Gene Simmons was reading in my like inner ear the whole time.
A good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as We Funk, or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the mothership, top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me? I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is...
Make mine the P-Funk. I want my funk uncut.
Make my funk.
Yeah, make my funk the P-Funk.
I want to get funked up.
Even aside from the book, it was fun just to go back and rediscover a lot of these albums. You know, obviously I've listened to most of Parliament and Funkadelic's joint catalog. I actually recently in the last year or so went back and wrote about quite a few of them for a website called Spectrum Culture. So I'll probably put up links to that. I wrote about, honestly, some pretty obscure ones. I wrote about the first Funkadelic album, the first Parliament album, Electric Spanking of War Babies, and a couple of like semi-canonical later albums. You know, I kind of deliberately gave myself more obscure stuff to write about. But that was fun to revisit, and it was fun to revisit again, because it's just like Callie was saying, the body of work is amazing. It's amazing what a condensed time period a lot of this stuff came out in. Like, I knew this intellectually, but I never really thought about the fact that Chocolate City and Mothership Connection came out in the same year. which is just wild, especially when you consider, because, you know, Chocolate City is a good album with some great songs, like especially the title track. But Mothership Connection is like a career highlight, like amazing album from beginning to end. And the fact that they recorded this just a little more than 6 months after Chocolate City is just so nuts. It's just the level of creativity. And then during that whole time, you know, that's just Parliament. Like Funkadelic also put out an album in that same year. And I think Bootsy's Rubber Band was January 76. Mothership Connection was December 1975. So literally the month after Mothership Connection came out. And again, that's like a classic album. The discography is so huge and there's so much there to explore. And it's just like the funkiest music ever recorded. Like I would put it above James Brown even.
I listened to Parliament Funkadelic before James Brown. So I don't know if it's different for someone who like experienced them chronologically, but I always preferred Parliament Funkadelic to James Brown. Didn't George Clinton also like mention that in the book too? I thought he mentioned something about them being funkier than James Brown.
Yeah. I think he did. Yeah, because he, you know, he's talking about, and that's one of the interesting things is you're really seeing he was there at ground zero for funk music. I mean, so basically,
and so was Bootsy. Bootsy played with George.
James Brown. Yes,
played with George Clinton. He also played with James Brown.
Yeah, in 19.
And I feel like that period of James Brown is my favorite period.
Right.
So
right.
Really, like those like couple of players, pretty much like George Clinton, Bootsy, Junie, and Sly Stone are like the things that make things funky for me, and Bernie too.
You know, this is a book. It's a book about a single person, George Clinton. And it's definitely, it has, you know, biases inherent to that. Like I know that some of the ex Parliament and Funkadelic members would probably not agree with a lot of what's said in this book, you know, because
well,
I think
Roger Troutman is conveniently dead. So he can't stand up for himself because there is not very many glowing things to say about Roger Troutman.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. But, you know, I think with that obvious caveat that George Clinton wasn't the only person behind this music, I think he is actually, you know, fairly generous about the legacy and all of the different voices that kind of went into creating that
music.
Yeah,
I was gonna mention that too, because even though like he was not very complimentary about Roger Troutman, like I feel like to a certain extent he definitely gave credit where it's due and like mentioned things like this wasn't my idea, this was this person's idea. Like he seemed pretty diplomatic about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and he's also has a good sense of what his strengths and his weaknesses are. You know, like he's aware of his vocal limitations, but he also knows that there's something about his voice that really works for P-Funk. And you know, he's aware that he's not a sort of traditional, you know, musical genius and instrumentalist on the level of somebody like Bernie Worrell, but he can take, there's some interesting parts where he talks about like Bootsy bringing in songs for Parliament. And it was like, just like basic funk, you know, it wasn't P-Funk yet until George kind of got his hands on it. And, you know, he talks about, again, Roger Troutman, when they brought in what became More Bounce to the Ounce. And at least according to George Clinton, he's the one who kind of made it into More Bounce to the Ounce. You know, it was like just this kind of decent funk jam. And he kind of stripped it down to the bare essentials and, you know, emphasized certain. So like basically his aesthetic and his skills as a producer, I think there's some interesting analysis there. And you know, sometimes it's also like, sometimes I kind of wonder if he's being sort of strategically modest, because you know, like he talks about early on in the group, the record company kind of putting pressure on Funkadelic to have a frontman. And he makes it sound like he really like resisted that idea. And I'm like, did you really, like, you know, or is this,
yeah,
are you just trying to make
true.
It be more like a democracy?
Yeah, because like he'll give people credit, but also there's a lot of points where it's like, oh, everything was your idea, huh?
Yeah, right.
Like, I can't even remember, but there were some points where it's like just like ridiculous stuff where it's like he came up with some word or something. Yeah. He's like, damn, everything was George's idea, huh?
Yeah, and I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of disputes within like the P-Funk camp about you know, people not getting paid enough. And if you ask George, at least, like, I don't have an educated idea about any of this because it's all like it's all just like legal squabbling the last 100 pages of this book. And I mean, even more than that, if you count the appendices, which literally has a legal brief in the appendix, this really turns into a document of court battles over ownership of you know, the P-Funk catalog. And it certainly seems to be accurate the way George Clinton describes it, that basically they were all getting screwed. And I think there's a lot of resentment directed toward him. Like, I especially see, if you follow Bernie Worrell's page on Facebook, Bernie's widow is not a big fan of George Clinton. and she makes that painfully clear. And you know, I don't know who is in the right and who is in the wrong. And I'm sure that the reality, like, the truth is probably not all in any one person's account, but at least reading this book, it feels to me like they were all being screwed. And because George Clinton was sort of like the public face of the group, he was maybe screwed a little bit less than the rest of the band, but it's not like he was intentionally. I honestly think I came away from this thinking that he is a bad businessman, for one thing, you know, like didn't have a lot of, even when he was clean, didn't have a lot of business acumen. Like the whole thing with Roger Troutman, you know, their label did handshake agreements, which made it possible for Roger to take his masters and bring them to Warner Brothers and put out his album on Warner Brothers instead of Uncle Jam Records, because he didn't actually have a contract with Uncle Jam, you know? So like, there's stuff like that where it's just that I think that George Clinton was not a great businessman, nor did he need to be, but the people who were handling his affairs were crooks, you know? And then also, the majority, like the last, I would say, third of this book, again, he's strung out on hard drugs, and it's even easier to kind of take advantage of him. So that's kind of where I came away from it, is that this is a mess, but it's not necessarily his fault, at least in the sense, I don't think he was maliciously withholding royalties from the band or anything like that. And it does really seem like a major injustice has been done, because again, this is one of the great catalogs in 20th century music. And you had, you know, these managers and record label people and just doing like flagrantly illegal stuff, like
the
making
whole
up
second
pseudonyms.
Half of the book is all just legal trouble, pretty
right,
much.
Right.
Like the first half is interesting because it's pretty much split into two books almost. Like the first half of the book is the creative part and like the artists, like the visual artists and the musical artists, obviously, that went into making the music and how it was recorded and stuff. And I thought that was interesting because most of the books we read don't have any of that.
Yeah, like, exactly. And that's like a recurring complaint for us. I mean, there was a little bit like Paul Stanley's book. He talked about, he had that like that very, you know, Lick My Love Pump-esque passage talking about his inspiration for Lick It Up, you know. But like, obviously that couldn't carry a whole book. And then a lot of the, I mean, David Lee Roth had fuck all to say about his music. Like, he had opinions about everything other than his music, you know. So yeah, I mean, I do think that this is like, This is a book that has some interest beyond just wacky stories, although there is definitely some of that. And I would even say that the wackiest stories are not necessarily George's stories. Like, honestly, this made me want to read a Sly Stone book because some of the stuff that happens with Sly is crazy. I'm sure we'll get to it, but there's a part where the way he describes it, it sounds like a cartoon where basically Sly blew up the front of his house in a obviously crack.
Oh my God! Right.
A crack related mishap, and he was just like standing like in this exposed front of a house, and then he just went back and into his room and shut the door. There's a little bit of that, you know, with George Clinton and with Funkadelic, but they're actually, I would say, more, there's less zaniness than you might expect from the band that, you know, wore diapers on stage and came out of the mothership and all of that stuff. And he even said that, you know, he had his wild moments or whatever, but he liked to kind of play up his craziness for the stage. And he's a normal guy who was on crack cocaine for 29 years of his life, but he's a more normal guy than you would expect from seeing, you know, the crazy hair and the you know, again, the diaper, like all of that stuff.
I recall when I left a little town in North Carolina. I tried to escape this music. I said it was for the old country folks. I went to New York, got slick, got my hair laid. I was cool. I was cool. But I had no groove.
No groove, no groove, no groove.
No groove. I had no groove. But now, fly on, baby.
Cause I can.
Fly on, baby. You got it. You got it now.
You got it.
Fly on. Fly on, sisters. Play on, brother.
You got it.
And I think that's also kind of borne out because this is not a book that wastes a lot of time on the early stuff. You know, he kind of, it's a couple of chapters in that already the parliaments are together. And even in his childhood and teenage memories, a lot of the stories that he tells are about other people in his neighborhood, you know, not so much about himself. I feel like we don't really get a sense of who George Clinton was as a kid or as a teenager. This is much more about the persona.
There's a little bit of how he was growing up, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like there's enough of it. Like, really, right. I wish I knew less about Peter Criss's growing up and like how Ace Frehley was growing up. Like, I really don't need that.
Yeah.
There's enough about his upbringing that's relevant to who he became as a person and what influenced the music. And that's what I like about it. Like, there was just enough information about his personal life.
Yeah, this feels, again, I think we said this about, because we read both Rick James books, and I think we said this about Glow, that this is a really good argument for having an actual writer write your book when you're a musician.
Right.
You know, because this book feels, I think, very judiciously edited. Again, I'm looking at David Lee Roth when I say this, it has
right.
it has a narrative that it tells all of the stories are there for a reason. It feels very like thematically focused. You're never confused about what's going on or what time.
Was this the book that I mentioned to you that it kind of jumps around a lot chronologically? No, that was Grace Jones's book, but George Clinton's is kind of similar in that, like, he'll be telling an anecdote and then it will jump back to something from like his childhood or when he worked at the barbershop or whatever, but it will make sense and right. I'll know exactly what period he's talking about. Like, whereas David Lee Roth could be talking about filming the video to California Girls, and then next paragraph he's ranting about Israel or something.
Yeah, right.
And then next paragraph he's in Dave Land somewhere. Yeah. And I don't know what the timeline on any of it is. Whereas this one very much flowed like a conversation would, in an actual like conversation with someone who is coherent and like, yeah, you know, right. you can follow what they're saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You might remember early on when he was in New Jersey, he talked about the Whammo hula hoop factory coming to town. And I thought this was interesting because one of the first things that happens in this book, this is on page 20, is George Clinton flagrantly violating child labor laws. Like,
right. Yeah.
Says he was in a gang called the Outlaws, by which he meant a group of guys to run with and not much more than that. They went to the hula hoop factory and got jobs. But the company was so far behind in meeting the demand for this craze and so out of its depth that it didn't organize the labor force to make new hoops. As luck would have it, the Outlaws discovered a way to make the hoops and to make them fast. We figured out that the process of putting the hoops together would be great fun for kids who were 6, 8 years old, and we employed them. The hoops were fashioned from these long strips of plastic. You took one end and then the other, and then you made them meet in the middle. And voila, a hoop. The kids had so much fun making the hoops that the Outlaws would just punch in for our shifts, leave the kids alone to do the work, and come back later. We had so many kids out at the factory that we started to overproduce hoops. Like,
I also think it's interesting that that's kind of like, that mimics kind of what Parliament Funkadelic was, wasn't it? It was George Clinton kind of like leading people and then letting them do most of the work.
Right. Exactly. It really does like set the precedent. And you know, again, because like this is a book that was written by a writer and it has themes, you know, that like assembly line idea comes back, never really, like, he doesn't ever really examine the fact that he was using child labor to do this. But that part is kind of, you know, conveniently glossed over, but he does talk about, obviously, one of the interesting things I think about the Parliaments and early Funkadelic is that they were in Detroit at the time of Motown. And so they became like this weird parallel, like Motown on acid, you know, because Motown in the 60s and was very conservative, you know, it was very much like Tin Pan Alley style. You know, you had staff songwriters, you had staff producers, staff session musicians who were, you know, now we know them as the Funk Brothers, but they were not credited at the time. It was this assembly line approach to making music. And even in the early 70s, when you had people like Marvin Gaye with What's Going On and Stevie Wonder with all of his albums in the early 70s, there was this kind of loosening of the reins a little bit with Motown. But even then, they were still a lot more conservative than what you were getting out of Funkadelic. So there were like this weird alternative version of, you know, Detroit's R&B scene. And even, you know, later in the 70s, when they kind of built their own empire, you can see them as this alternative version of Motown, you know? And so I think that assembly line idea comes back a lot throughout the book in a really interesting way, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
another like early anecdote that I don't, you know, I don't really have anything to say about, but when the parliaments would drive from New Jersey to Detroit and back, he said that one time they were driving through Pennsylvania and they drove onto the set of Night of the Living Dead.
Right. I originally heard that story on the Tales from the Tour Bus.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting.
Because I watched that probably a month before I read this book. I just bought all of the episodes on YouTube and watched them. So yeah, it was just kind of funny to like, I had already heard that story there, and it was just kind of funny to like read it again, like slightly different and not animated, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, Tales from the Tour Bus is really good. You need to read that or watch that.
Yeah, I know I do, because I heard about it, you know, and somebody on, I was going to mention this later, but somebody on our YouTube channel, it was Jive Side Productions, recommended that to us. I definitely want to check it out.
That story is in it, and also the one where he sets fire to the curtains in his hotel room because he set the tissue in his nose on fire with his crack pipe. That one is also in Tales from the Tour Bus.
Okay. So I really want to see that one animated. So yeah, that is.
Yeah, I would get, because there's like, okay, so there's Bootsy's.
Right.
There's James Brown's and George Clinton. So those are all good. Plus, there's a Morris Day one that's amazing. Yeah, they do Rick James. So they're all kind of like interconnected. And then there's a Betty Davis one, and I love Betty Davis. So like Betty Davis is not so much interconnected with everyone, but I'm really glad they did her because I love Betty Davis, and I feel like she doesn't get talked about enough. But yeah, anyway.
If she ever does a book, then we'll absolutely do it for Dystopian Book Club. But anyway, I love that Vanilla Fudge gets a shout out, because
that's something that's really interesting to me. I mean, you can tell from listening to Parliament Funkadelic's music,
right?
But it's really interesting, like how much George Clinton cites his like influences and like who he took ideas from and how he was really influenced by a lot of the like Cream and like psychedelic rock and stuff, which you can definitely hear in Funkadelic especially. But it's just so interesting because like I grew up listening to Parliament Funkadelic, but I also grew up listening to a lot of his influences. So it's like interesting that like me and George Clinton were listening to the same things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's interesting to see what he cites too, because like obviously you listen
it
to
it all makes sense too.
Right.
You can hear it and be like, oh yeah, like I totally hear that.
Right. Yeah, obviously, you know, you can hear the Parliaments started out as a doo-wop group, and that's like really obvious from P-Funk. You know, they basically through their whole career, they would have like a song that was obvious, like this was either based on something that they used to do when they were a doo-wop group, or it's like a throwback to that style.
And even like later when it was less doo-wop-y, the use of like voices, like the almost like Temptations, like voices in the background where they're being a guy with a super deep voice. And then
they're always like, voice, like a vocal group, even after the original, you know, Grady and those guys left. There was always like, they were always structured as a kind of classic vocal group. So, I mean, you know, that's all obvious, but I think it's interesting. When he names his influences, the Beatles are almost always on there, which I find really interesting. And I can absolutely see. And, you know, he kind of uses the Beatles as this, like, that was sort of what we were aspiring to in terms of our, like, conceptual ideas. You know, like, he compares Motor Booty Affair. You know, he considers that, like, their Sgt. Pepper. And it's, like, as funny as that sounds, you know, because they're two very different kinds of albums, I can absolutely see what he means.
Yeah.
And you can hear how that was.
Right, especially when you hear, like, the actual song Motor Booty Affair, it sounds similar to, like, the first track on Sgt. Pepper.
Right, right.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, you gotta see this. This is exciting, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to say this is Howard Godsell reporting for the Motor Booty Affair. We're seeing all kinds of people coming in here now. We got Queen Frequently, we got Charlie Tooth over there in the corner trying to talk to every second. This is really fantastic. We want you to stick around. We got a lot of things planned for you.
I think it's also cool just because, you know, I am a big fan of Detroit music of all kinds. And so it's cool to see like the MC5 show up. And it's the part where they show up is funny because it kind of like, this is an interesting book because obviously a lot of political things were happening around Parliament, especially in the late 60s and early 70s. And, you know, George Clinton doesn't really, he says a few times in the book that he doesn't really see himself as like a political figure, you know, like he's not really comfortable taking political stands necessarily. He likes to couch it in humor, but he also is just very sharp about certain political dynamics. And he talks about the White Panthers and about the MC5. And, you know, when the MC5 show up, they're basically, they're on a plane with Funkadelic and they're all like openly smoking weed and being loud and obnoxious. And Funkadelic is like, you guys need to shut the fuck up because if the cops come, they're going to arrest us. You know, they're going to arrest the black guys.
Right. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting too. And I, man, what was I, was it, I think Iggy Pop had something to say about the like White Panther Party and stuff too, which is that like, maybe it was when I saw him at, because I saw him speak at the DA, maybe it was then that he mentioned something about how like their whole platform was just like fucking in the streets, which
right.
I knew that because I've read Guitar Army, but it's just funny because I feel like from reading John Sinclair's point of view, it sounds like he's like, yeah, like we side with the Black Panthers and everything, but then like, do you really? Because it sounds like you just want to take drugs and fuck in the street.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a much. I feel like the White Panthers, you know, they were radical, but the rigor of their politics was lacking compared to the Black Panthers.
Right.
And yeah, there's a, I can't find it in the book, but there's a good passage in this book where he talks about the White Panthers and he said that they would come up to, you know, everybody and be like, brother, are you on our side? Kind of a thing. And George Clinton was like, well, what do you mean brother? You know, right. like what, We're not brothers, you know, racially. Like, he kind of like sees through a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
So which is interesting. Even though, you know, they were very much part of the counterculture. Like, if you go back and read some early reviews of Funkadelic stuff, there was a lot of concern in the like rock. I know that like Robert Christgau mentions it a couple times. He's like very not pleased that Funkadelic had liner notes by the people from the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And, you know, George is sort of like, he talks about that a little bit in this book and he's like, I don't know, they seemed fine. You know, like, like the whole Manson stuff didn't come out until later. So we just thought they were like, they're just kind of like there in all of this political kind of turmoil during that period. Another thing, you know, right after the MC5 moment, the Funkadelic kind of gets punished for Frank Zappa and the Mothers playing the Royal Albert Hall and playing their 19th century pipe organ. So they get banned from playing at the Albert Hall. So it's just kind of funny, like seeing them on the outskirts of this 60s, early 70s rock scene. And basically these white acts are jeopardizing their potential for success.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting too, because like that definitely is like evident in there, but George Clinton never like right out says it, but it's interesting how that like appears in the narrative if you're paying attention.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We sort of touched on this before, but some of my favorite passages were just basically talking about how Parliament became, you know, what they were basically. And so he talks about like when Bernie came in, he was kind of like the sort of musical catalyst. And that's a lot of the weirdness and complexity of their horn charts are because of him, or because, you know, like Bernie would do some of the horn charts and Fred Wesley would do others of the horn charts. So from Fred Wesley, you get like the, you know, classic James Brown funk kind of stuff. And from Bernie, you get the kind of more experimental stuff, and then put that together. And that was Parliament Sound. And he talks about, obviously, Bootsy being sort of like their public face after George became the public face, like Bootsy kind of took over in that way.
And I think it's interesting that Bootsy couldn't handle it and he like got shingles from stress.
Yeah, it is interesting because he seems like of all the people, he was like born to be that character. But yeah, I did think that was interesting. He talks about Pedro Bell, who passed away recently. And you know, that's like that's a huge part of this group. And that's a big part of this book, too, is it kind of cheapens it to say branding. But just like visually, Parliament and Funkadelic, that was a big part of their appeal. Just like the whole package, not just, I mean, the obvious stuff is the costumes and the mothership, but you know, the album covers and the logos, they tell this like really cohesive story. And I think that's part of what kind of makes them such an interesting group. I can't think of another, I mean, you had like the Ohio Players had those, like the like cheesecake centerfoldy album covers, but this was like on a different level in terms
this
of
this was like this kind of like characterized them more because they look like comic book art,
right
so it made it like it made the world more real in the way that like comic book characters are real, whereas just like because a lot of the characters appeared on the actual album covers,
yeah,
and so it made that whole like it just made like the world that they were creating realer than I think it would have been if they'd been using just like photographs. Cause you look at like the first couple of albums that weren't using Pedro Bell's art. Well, there's a different, who is the, it was Overton Lloyd, was it, who did the Parliament art?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there were two like different artists, which that made it interesting too. Well, I think Pedro Bell's art is comic booky too, mm-hmm. though.
It's just like different genres of comic book basically.
Yeah. And I like that they were two separate artists for the two bands,
right.
But they were both like cohesive.
Yeah, exactly. And it gives each band a discrete identity. That's one of the interesting things about Parliament and Funkadelic. It's all the same musicians. They were recording at the same time in the same studios, you know, with the same songwriters. Clinton was producing everything. And there is definitely, you know, like, especially later in the 70s, like, you know, One Nation Under a Groove and Uncle Jam are not necessarily wildly different from what Parliament was doing at the time, but they're still sort of different. And then, I mean, earlier in the 70s, they really feel like two totally different groups. You know, Funkadelic is a lot kind of darker and weirder, and Parliament is a little more, you know, lighter and more like also weird, but cartoonish, I guess. And that is definitely reflected, you know, like Cosmic Slop has a totally different art style than, you know, a Motor Booty Affair or something like that.
Right.
To hide the fact from us that life was really tough. I can hear my mother call. I can hear my mother call. Late at night I hear a call. On the Lord I hear a call. She said, Father, Father, it's for the kids. Any and everything I did. Please, please don't judge me too strong.
I was gonna point out a couple of good stories, but it's probably This is a book that's worth reading, so maybe I shouldn't ruin a lot of them.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't remember a lot of them. The only thing I can remember is what I took pictures of, which is that goddamn dog album.
Yeah, let's talk about the dog album. Let's talk a little bit about the second half of the book, because, you know, again, like you said, this is very much like a rise and fall narrative. and the rise is like a lot of fun to read. And, you know, I would say, to George's credit, to Ben Greenman's credit, it doesn't become like a slog to get through the book, even though court proceedings and crack addiction, they're both things that could easily get old fast. And I do feel like the book does a good job of staying interesting. But it definitely is, you know, like, if you're a fan of the music, it's a lot less interesting to hear about how, you know, his later albums are made. I think partly because he doesn't really remember as well. Like, I mean, he talks about like Atomic Dog. And he basically said that he came into the studio and these two, the guys he was working with, had this the beat for Atomic Dog playing. And he got paranoid because he was, you know, on crack. And he was like, I got to put something on this before they take this album away from me, basically. And, you know, so that's why Atomic Dog is mostly like spoken. It's not really, because the song basically wasn't written when he like improvised the lyrics, you know. And so like, he didn't really have, you know, it's not like he sat down and wrote Atomic Dog, you know, like it was sort of like this weird confluence of things that the producers were working on. And then he came in and did this improv. And so there's a little less insight into the creative process later, is basically what I'm saying. Cause like, that's Atomic Dog. That's like by far his biggest song of the 80s. So if he doesn't have much to say about that, he doesn't have much to say about anything, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely interesting. So the dog album, that's the like concept album about drug dogs, right?
Yes. So not Atomic Dog.
No.
It was Mad Dogs in the 80s. Mad music about dogs.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Yeah.
It Atomic is kind of... Dog is definitely the better of the dog related like dog concepts.
Right. And we can go back to the Drug Dogs album, but this actually touches on a couple of interesting things. He does talk about like the origin of the dog obsession, and you know, he traces it to like Rufus Thomas with Walking the Dog, and common phrases like Dog Day Afternoon, It's a Dog's Life, stuff like that. And it's kind of a window into the way that P-Funk songs were conceived. Like, it's a lot of free association, basically, but in a really kind of clever way that is touching on these, you know, wordplay and the sort of like history of soul and pop and blues music. And Atomic Dog is one really obvious example of that. But he talks about other things through the book. And this sort of reminded me, because he said that when they were writing Motor Booty Affair, it was obviously this underwater, you know, fish theme. And he stockpiled a bunch of fish puns. So when he 5 years later went and recorded his album, his solo album, You Shouldn't Have Bit Fish, that was, he used that as like an excuse to go back to his fish puns, like the ones that he didn't use the first time.
dog theme probably should have been left alone though.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's definitely, he definitely returns to that well a lot. Like, one of the albums that I reviewed was the album that came out right around the same time as this, First You Gotta Shake the Gate, which is actually, I was honestly surprised, because, you know, I definitely was not following George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic for a long stretch of time. Like, I was, you know, I discovered their 70s stuff when I was a teenager, and I just like, I distinctly remember them playing at like the Grammys or the MTV VMAs or something, and they sounded so rough. They were just like old, and George like didn't have any range left in his voice. He was just, it was just like a
Was like this like in like 2004 or whatever?
I think so.
Early
2000s. Yeah, I think so. It was just like they were playing Give Up the Funk, Tear the Roof Off.
Yep, I remember. And
he was just like having trouble getting even just the like chant. Like he wasn't even singing. He was having trouble getting that out. And what's interesting is that he doesn't directly address that performance, but he talks about later in the book when he like kicks crack, he talks about how his voice came back because like he wasn't burning caustic rocks in his throat every day. So it's just like that really like put it into perspective. Like, oh yeah, smoking crack would like absolutely fuck your voice. Like, so you know, I wasn't following Funkadelic for a long time, so I just kind of assumed that all of their new stuff was bad. And I will say that First You Gotta Shake the Gate is a lot. It's like 3 hours of music. It's 33 songs. The like conceit is it's 33 songs for 33 years of Funkadelic. And, you know, he had like just stopped doing crack when that album came out. And so it's like, just imagine. And I was like listening to a really concentrated dose of it because I had to write about it. So just imagine having headphones on for like 2 or 3 days and just having George Clinton just bellowing in your ear about dogs for like 3 hours at a time. It was an intense experience, but it wasn't a bad album. I will definitely, but there were a few too many dog songs on it though. I will say that.
Yeah. I gotta say too, that, I mean, I haven't listened to it, so I don't know if this is a fair statement, but like, if you read like T-Rex lyrics,
mm-hmm.
terrible. Like they sound so stupid, but when you listen to them, it's good.
Yeah.
So like, I feel like maybe these shouldn't have been the lyrics that got printed in the book, because these are like the only, like sometimes you would like reference a phrase from a Funkadelic song or reference a phrase from a Parliament song or something. These are the only lyrics that got printed in like poem form on the page, and they're just the dumbest shit, like just stuff about fucking dogs.
Is this really intelligible?
It doesn't make any sense.
U.S. Custom Coast Guard dope dog, keen yeah. sense of smell, tracking the telltale trails of cartels, dope boats, big dope, never a gram or OZ, kilo too low key, gotta be tons of pee blow, bales of lumbo, when other dogs sniff at other dogs' tails. He can track the profits from a dope sale straight to the stank account. Yeah, it is sort of... yeah, it is like... P-Funk always feels to me like very much in the oral tradition, you know, like it's weird seeing their lyrics written out. And
but it was so much better as Parliament Funkadelic because it wasn't, because this is when he started, I mean, this is when, first of all, like hip hop became a thing.
Right.
And George Clinton was like being embraced by rappers. And so he literally says, like, I think right before he starts talking about this goddamn dog songs, about how like he, like his lyricism was getting better. Yeah. And then he starts talking, and the next page is U.S. Customs Coast Guard dope dog, which it's like a tongue twister.
Yeah. And it is like, it's really like the concept. I actually want to, I want to hear this album actually, because it's a really interesting concept, the inspiration of it. Like he says on the previous page, he said it started out with a simple curiosity sparked by a news story I saw about what happened to drug dogs when they retired from the police force or the DEA. they were cast aside and basically left to die, I started asking myself questions about the life that those dogs were forced to live. In the process of being trained to look for drugs, they had to sniff for drugs, which means that they got a habit. When they were finished, they were strung out and incapable of doing anything else. It was the existence of an addict. Then I started to look into other uses and misuses of dogs, and I was struck by how many of them were related to drugs in some way. Drug dealers always had pit bulls with them for protection. In Michigan, there were university labs where they experimented on animals, dogs with rods in their heads being used for everything from behavior modification to cosmetics testing. So these are like some really like fascinating and ideas.
Fascinating ideas, but they're culminated in just say ding in parentheses, dad a boy. I just want to, I imagine like reading this at like an open mic. Just say ding dong and I'm sprung. I spring every time a bell is rung. I'm not a ding-a-ling. I'm not a ding-dong. Mine is another story told of a goddamn laboratory. Biological, illogical. Where's the logic in a rod that's lodged in your head till you're dead?
Here we go again. Look out. Just say ding-dong. Biological, illogical. Where's the logic in a rod that's lodged in your head till you're dead? Fuck the dumb shit. Just go to the top of the food chain. You wanna suck and fuck with my brain? All in the name of science, science. Blinding me with science. Data, what the fuck the data matter to me? I ain't trying to hear that, see?
And I noticed this throughout the book, and you know, again, like I get what he's saying when he talks about, you know, some of these lines being like really great. Well, I'm not those ones, but there are like great lines in P-Funk songs. But again,
no, I agree with that. But these goddamn dog songs have got to go.
Yeah.
I will never agree that they are good songs.
Again, I think it actually says a lot about like how George Clinton's mind works. Cause it's like, he concentrates so many ideas into one small phrase, you know, because he's a songwriter and he's like a poet in that sense. You know, he's not an essayist or a novelist. So he doesn't draw these ideas out and explain them. He'll talk about all of these concepts and then he'll say, and then this line really just solidified all of that. And then he'll just give, you know, like for example, from Mothership Connection, he says in the title song, we introduce Starchild, another character who was an alien who brought funk to Earth. I folded in the chariots of the gods mythology, sprinkled some contemporary science fiction on the top and stirred it all together. And then just a two-line quote, we have returned to claim the pyramids, parting on the mothership. It's like...
But you know what? But that does work, though. Like, that's right. The thing. That it totally works.
Right.
And, like, so many people that totally gets, like, drawn out by everyone. Like, everyone knows exactly what he's talking about. You don't need to write an essay. So, like, I get exactly what he's saying because I always understood that, too, even before reading that. Like, I understood what he was saying. So I think that's where the beauty of it comes, is that like when, and I actually like George Clinton's writing when he's literally just saying like offhand phrases more than I like when he's writing a poem about fucking dogs. Not fucking dogs, but like dogs.
Although there are a lot of songs about dogs fucking also.
Yeah, Atomic Dog is about dogs fucking, so, and I like that better than any of these drug dog songs, so.
Talking about the hip-hop thing, it is, I think George Clinton is a really interesting case study for this because he's one of the like themes throughout this book is really early in Funkadelic's career. He talks about overhearing a couple of women talking about their show and they're like, oh, you know, it's just, they're just like a guitarist, a bass player and some old fool. And that like really stuck with him and like made him feel bad. And it kind of recurs throughout the book. He has this interesting like attitude toward aging, and he's very like upfront about how, you know, he does not want to be like left behind. And there's this interesting dynamic where I think you mentioned this just in passing earlier, that even when Funkadelic first came out, you know, they'd already been around like for, as the Parliaments, they'd been around for like 10 years before then. You know, they hadn't been famous, but they were not 20 when the first Funkadelic album came out.
Yeah,
they,
at least George Clinton was, because that's another thing that I think I know where you're going with this, but also like with his groups, he always had like younger people in them. So there was always like a mix of ages.
Yeah. So he's always like, he's very conscious of wanting to keep his music fresh and sort of like keep himself young by bringing new blood in. And yeah, so you see that with Bootsy even before that. I mean, the Funkadelic lineup was constantly changing. And then you see that later with Amp Fiddler and Judy Morrison was a big one in the late 70s. And then also with hip hop, you know, like he was one of the more welcoming, like, quote unquote, old guard people. He understood hip hop in a way that a lot of other people of his generation didn't. And there's some really interesting parts in this book where he talks about sampling, and Parliament's management was very litigious, and he didn't want to sue people for sampling. You know, he thought he should be paid for the hooks or whatever that got sampled, but he talks about how if it was up to him and not up to the management, they would have come up with a much more sort of sensible, equitable pay structure. Would have had to do with like how many records get sold, you know, what's the obviousness of the sample, instead of like trying to chase down every little connection and like often just being litigious just as a way to make money, you know, not as a way to protect copyright and to protect sort of artists' rights. So he has these really kind of progressive ideas about copyright and also just about music in general. I don't think he said it here, but I've read him say somewhere that he likes to find the music that other people his age say isn't music, because that's like where the cutting edge is. And I always thought that was like a really interesting thing about him.
Everything that saying, and just in the nick of time, it came along and threw me a rope, but you threw me both ends of the line. We got stopped by the cops, he searched your purse and y'all walked off, and I saw you give him a sign. Oh yeah, he walked back kind of far, searching me and off the car, he had something in his hand, looked like drug show was, and he said it was mine. This is what I mean when I say, if I didn't love you, I didn't like you at all. Swear to God, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't like your ass at all. Sometimes.
And I also think there's a sense of, I think this book is an interesting, it has some interesting perspectives on intellectual property and on that whole issue. He even talks about, you know, this book was written after the whole Blurred Lines thing. And he basically says, you know, I would have loved to have written Blurred Lines. Like that was, I don't think that was theft. And I think his perspective is interesting because this is somebody who's been totally dicked over by the music industry, but he still has the like clarity of thought to understand like who is the one doing the dicking. You know, he's like, it wasn't rappers that screwed me out of my money. It was the labels and management. Rappers are artists, you know, like the real problem, like all artists should be in the same boat together. The real problem is the people who are just exploiting all of us, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perspective that you don't see as much, especially from, you know, his generation.
And that was really what made, like, the second half of the book is a lot of like legal stuff, but he has an interesting perspective on it. It's not really just like writing what happened. It's like he actually is like thinking about it you know what I mean? And like, actually like having an opinion about it rather than just being like, well, I got dicked over. He's saying like, this happened and this shouldn't be happening. And he's like, don't let this happen to you kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Like, he's it like, kinda, it's like a warning message almost.
The book kind of becomes a thesis on artists' rights and intellectual property rights. And that kind of, you know, which is all like really important stuff. And I think it's still relevant. Now a lot of the debates are around, you know, he talks about downloading. I think this is a little bit, this was before streaming like really took off. But I, you know, I do kind of wonder what George Clinton's opinion on streaming is. Because when he talks about downloading, he basically says, well, you know, Casablanca would give away hundreds of records as loss leaders, you know, to get people to listen to the album. Downloading is actually probably a more cost-effective way of doing that for people to hear something before they
Thought that was really interesting too, that he mentioned that. I don't feel like that gets talked about enough, like that specific point. Like there's other stuff about downloading and, you know, like how artists mostly get paid in live shows and stuff, but that part of how the record industry works isn't really talked about in the argument about downloading and piracy and all that very often. So I thought it was interesting that he brought that up.
And the thing that always kind of frustrates me about, like, I don't think that, you know, streaming is a sustainable, there's obviously a lot of problems with it, and it's not sustainable. But I feel like what's left out of the conversation, like we're in such a hurry to talk about how Spotify and, you know, all of those companies are ripping off the artists, but the labels aren't complaining because they're still getting a sizable chunk of the profits. So like, isn't this just sort of another dimension of the same exploitation that was occurring with album sales? It's just that because the piece of the pie is even smaller, artists feel it more, you know? So, so to me, like it kind of comes back to the same essential, like what record labels are doing is immoral. They're just able to do it even more with streaming, you know?
So I
thought it was, this book, I think, kind of points us in that direction a little bit.
Yeah.
And he also has interesting things to say about the changes in the music industry in general, you know, that kind of put latter day Parliament and Funkadelic records in a different context. You know, he talks about how like he had all of these grand visual ideas for the 90s P-Funk All-Stars album, The Awesome Power of a Fully Operational Mothership. And whoever was his label at the time, Warner or whoever, was like, we don't even want to press CDs. You know, like we'll put it out on CDs with like a little card in the jewel case, and that's all you're going to get. And it makes you think about how, because like we said, so much of P-Funk was the packaging, you know, and which sounds like it's minimalizing it, but that's such a huge part of the experience. And it's, unless you're really making a point of doing it and really taking a loss on, you know, artwork, or if you're, you know, if you're fabulously wealthy and you can burn money on like vanity projects, the record industry nowadays, that's like a whole dimension that's missing, you know, and probably-
yeah, and even not even just in the records, but in like the stage show as well, like the. Part of it, I feel like the success of Parliament in the early days, obviously the music was like important, but the vehicle for it, which was their live show and having the actual mothership come down, like they wouldn't have been able to do that without the support of Casablanca Records at the time and how it was run in the 70s, which was lavish because it was the 70s.
Yeah, just like hemorrhaging, I mean, that's money, yeah.
Right, and I mean, that's the same thing with Kiss to a certain extent too. We were also on Casablanca, like a lot of bands that were visually appealing like that, like a lot of their popularity came from the fact that they had the backing of like wealthy record companies that were willing to pretty much like take chances on their creative vision. And that doesn't really happen anymore.
Yeah, exactly. P-Funk was such a product of its time, both like culturally, because I mean, we kind of mentioned it was coming out of this like ferment of the late 60s and all of these, you know, different countercultural ideas, LSD, like there's basically, again, there's this duality in this book, because there's two like moments where George Clinton, you know, takes a drug and is like, nothing's ever going to be the same again. And it's the first time is when he takes LSD in the late 60s. And the second time is when he smokes crack in the late 70s. And, you know, there's like these demarcating points. And so it is like culturally, financially, the way that people consumed music at the time, the way people went to live shows at the time. This couldn't happen in the 21st century, which isn't a knock against the 21st century, but it just kind of shows how special this was, I guess.
Hey, brother, can you paradigm? And as the shifting of the tectonic plate that causes the earth to quake, when you're standing in the epicenter, let the shaking begin. The shaking starts here. Hey, brother, can you paradigm? Like the shifting of the combined weight of the massive oglers with the head fake and fake the numbers off of one's chest. Brother, can you paradigm? Pump, pump, faint fade, forward jump, slam dunk in your face. From tip off to tap in, rushing, jumping, backboard crushing, dunking in your face. Brother, can you paradigm? Shape-shifting. Shifting the shapes of things to come.
I think that was a good ending statement. Do we have anything else to say?
No, not really. I mean, there's some really good stories in it, but I think, again, I don't want to spoil all of them. I will say, again, if Sly Stone ever wants to write a memoir, even if he just wants to write one and like email it to me,
yeah,
like without publishing it, that would be amazing. Cause Sly has some really good stories. There's a moment where Rick James is mentioned that is pretty funny. do you remember when they were talking about the Glory Hella Stupid album?
Kind of,
I guess Pedro Bell wrote somewhere in there,
right? Yeah,
don't shitty band, and Rick James thought that the donkey on the cover was supposed to be him.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember that.
As George Clinton said, I told him the donkey was too pretty to be him. I will say in the way of criticism, there are definitely some things that I would have liked to hear more about. And I mean, again, like this is the case with a lot of these books. He was going through a lot, so like he might not remember everything that happened in the 80s and 90s, but I would have liked to see more prints. I was really hoping for some good print stories, because he did, you know, two of his albums were on Paisley Park Records.
There was nothing about
I know
Bridge. He clearly just blocked, I know that out, which honestly, like, I wish I could as well.
Yeah, he mentioned,
I say that, but I'm gonna probably watch it again. Like,
I watched it. I was going to say, I would have really loved to see, like, I want to know what that experience was like.
Honestly, having just rewatched it like 2 months ago or so, I don't think he was even like awake for it. <'Cause>, like, he doesn't seem to know what he's doing when he's on stage doing Weekend Funk. And then the only other scene I really remember him in is when he signs off the club to Morris. And it just like zooms in on him and he shrugs and that's it. Like,
yeah, he was probably actually on set for like
Morris the
amount of time he was on screen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And also like,
there's really no reason for him to even be in the damn movie. Like, at least Mavis Staples has a song that she performs. George Clinton literally just like lip syncs and then shrugs in the camera when he signs his club off. Which, honestly, fuck that club. Like, I'm glad. Like, that was the one that I'm like, yeah, that club could have been signed off. Because, like, what even was the theme?
Yeah, right.
Like, Mavis Staples was a church. Prince's was, like, I don't even know, like, a modern church. It was, like, he was, like, the cool youth group leader or whatever. Right. Yeah. And Morris, what the fuck was Morris's club? Like, it was just, like, generic nightclub. Really, the only one with a theme was Mavis Staples, and that's like, no one wants to go to a church nightclub.
Yeah.
So honestly, fuck all of those clubs. Like, just let Moors buy them up and hopefully do something more interesting with them. But anyway, that's for another time.
Yeah. You know, I actually realized it's the next year is the 20th anniversary of Graffiti Bridge. So we should do something around that. I would have liked to see something, but I think your point is taken. Like, he probably doesn't have any memories doesn't he talk about smoking in the bathroom or something at Paisley Park, or, oh no, it was at the House of Lords. I actually just found it. He did coke in the House of Lords.
Oh, yep. Okay. I remember that one. Yep.
But he probably also smoked at Paisley Park. So, I would have liked more. I would like more Prince stories. I would have liked, he mentions House Party in passing. But
I completely forgot about that. He was slightly more awake during House Party.
Yeah, he was actually. He was pretty. He had a couple of lines in that. So, So I would have liked to see his memories of being in House Party. He does talk about his appearance in PCU, which is honestly the least interesting of all of those. What about fucking Super Mario Brothers, the movie? Like his version of Walk the Dinosaur. That was.
Completely
absent.
I forgot about that. When I was reading it, I was waiting for it to get mentioned too, and it clearly like skated right over the everyone wishes they could too.
Right. If only all of our memory of the early 90s was as faulty as George Clinton. it's a blessing, really. So I do you know, definitely recommend this book. I think it was super interesting. It made me listen to a shitload of P-Funk, which it can only be a good thing. You know, like any excuse to go back and listen to Parliament and Funkadelic is a good thing. And, you know, I'll probably check out the Dope Dogs album and I'll report back on it and see if there is a buried gem in there. I do want to say, yeah. I do want to say one of our readers, I think this is Matt from Toronto. I think Matt, you have been very consistent, and I really appreciate it that when we put out the call for like a question or a comment to read on the show, you have risen to the occasion more than once now.
You have one question.
Exactly. But it's always a good one. It's always a good one too.
Right.
Because you know, if it was from one of our YouTube readers, it would be something about putting their balls in the blender. So, so in a way, I'd definitely rather have quality over quantity. So Matt said he finished the George Clinton autobiography. The question I have for you and Callie is whether you think there are any parallels between George Clinton's prolific output of material under both the Parliament and Funkadelic names, Funkadelic and Parliament names between 1975 and 1980, and Prince's side projects or contributions to protege groups such as The Time, Vanity 6, Apollonia 6, Maserati, The Family from about 1981 to 1985. In Prince's case, the side projects slowed down and he continued to produce stellar material for a few more years into the early 90s, whereas the 80s weren't as kind to George. I mean, I think that I totally agree with that. And I think it's just like an offhand thing, but I think George even mentions it. He talks about how like he saw that Prince was like, he did the two band thing too, except instead of him literally being both bands, Parliament and Funkadelic, his like Parliament, I guess. Yeah. Prince is probably Funkadelic. The Time is probably Parliament, but his Parliament was The Time. So he did the backing tracks and just got a new lead singer. But it is like, I never really thought about it that way, but it really is. You can see the influence of P-Funk on that decision, that idea.
Well, and I feel like at the time, especially because at the time were like more, they were charting more than Prince, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was like, because that was the thing with Parliament Funkadelic, is Parliament were like the hits, pretty right. much, like Mothership Connection. And then Funkadelic was more like, I guess, like to stick with the Prince analogy, like the more like artistic, like not really chart topping longer songs, etc. Whereas like,
right.
Yeah. So I guess that would be the connection. But I feel like now looking back, that would be less discernible, but I feel like at the time and like putting like Purple Rain into context too, because the first time I watched Purple Rain, I was like, what, like, why is The Time doing better than Prince?
What is this alternative universe where everyone loves The Time and hates Prince?
Like, right. Yeah, exactly.
But it actually like, was relevant to like a 36 month period in, right, in the real world. It's something I think you're probably right that it's like, because we're coming at it from, you know, backwards basically. Like if you were listening in 1981 and you saw Dirty Mind came out and then you saw The Time's first album come out, your frame of reference at that time probably would have been like, oh, this is, he's doing a, assuming you knew that both were by Prince, it's like, oh, he's doing a Parliament Funkadelic thing, you know?
Right, yeah.
And that's definitely what George Clinton took away from it. Now it feels so much like Prince's thing that I think that kind of gets buried. But I think that there's a lot of, I think we all like superficially understand that George Clinton and P-Funk were an influence on Prince because he said so. But, you know, it's the side project thing. It's the slowed down and sped up voices, you know, like everybody kind of acknowledges Erotic City is like a P-Funk kind of thing. But I mean, Scarlet Pussy is like literally, I mean, that honestly, George Clinton should have recorded Scarlet Pussy. That would have been amazing.
Prince should have recorded We Can Fun. Like obviously he did, but like that should have come out.
Right.
Instead of the George Clinton version. Cause the George Clinton version, like it's not even George Clinton-y.
Yeah, right. I know it is a weird, yeah. And you know, and then you have like even beyond the main two band split, like when you get into like, I mean, Vanity Six and Apollonia Six were very much in the Parlet Brides of Funkenstein kind of vein, you know, just like having a girl version of the main band. And you know, that's also something with a larger history that George Clinton talks about too. Like he talks about how back in the doo-wop era, it would you'd have a girl group spinoff that would have like a feminized version of the main band's name. So yeah, I think the connections are really interesting. And I think there's also, it also just reminded me, you know, obviously being a big Prince fan and doing a blog where I'm writing about everything Prince did, including the side projects. It really kind of drives home how prolific he was when you're like, it takes you 6 months to get to get through an album because it's so many fucking songs, you know. But reading and like slowing down and realizing, like I was saying at the beginning, like, oh, there were only 6 months between these albums, like these crazy, like incredible albums that most bands would be thrilled if they had with 3 years between them. There was less than a year. Funkadelic's like 70s peak reminds me in a lot of ways of Prince's 80s peak, you know, both because of the side projects and because of the prolificness and just, you know, generally the sense that like he could do anything or you know like you've got Funkadelic, they're as good a rock band as most rock bands, and then obviously their funk music is like world class also. And I think that was something that Prince definitely aspired to and I think accomplished in the 80s. Like he sort of, in a way that I think was not expected, because I, you know, Rick James sounds more like P-Funk, Zapp and Roger Troutman sound a lot more like P-Funk, but I think Prince was the one, and George Clinton also acknowledges this too, that Prince was the one who kind of took on the mantle in the 80s. Like he was sort of the one who ended up picking up where P-Funk left off. And yeah, there was some interesting stuff too about, you know, he talked about in the context of Judy Morrison about how much he values collaboration and how like having other guys, other like people in the studio to bounce ideas off of was a big part of what made P-Funk what it was. And, you know, he doesn't like, it's not like he's explicitly throwing shade at Prince, but he does kind of, the implication is sort of that like Prince would have been even better if he, you know, kind of let other people into his sphere a little bit more, which I've definitely heard that argument before. I do think it's, I do think it's an argument that's very convenient to George Clinton's skill set,
right?
Because because George Clinton could not, you know, go in and track a song from you know, top to bottom and like produce it himself and play all the instruments. So it is like a, it makes sense that he would feel that way because he needs those other, you know, he needs the children making hula hoops for him.
Right.
But it is interesting just to see his, like, his views on how to make a great record, because like there's a very short list of people who know better how to make a great record than George Clinton does. So yeah, I think that's it. Thank you again, Matt, for writing in. Thank you, everybody else, for listening. I don't know exactly what we're going to do next. I think it would be fun to do something again for Halloween, kind of like we did last year where we did the live stream. I'll have to find a way to, like, not get it taken off of YouTube, like find some kind of trickery to do. And, you know, maybe we'll try and pick something obscure that YouTube doesn't know, but I we'll definitely do this at the last minute. So I don't have anything for now. I also think, we were talking about like what makes a good dystopian book club book. And I think, Morris Day's book just came out.
Oh my God. Yeah. Today. We were talking about that.
Yeah.
The
day that we're recording this was the day that book came out. And I think it's going to be, I have it on my Kindle. I pre-ordered it and I'm probably going to finish it like over the weekend is my guess. I think it's, from what I've read of it, it's going to be a fast read. So, I think that might be fun to do that next. So
yeah, I'll have to pick up a copy somewhere.
Yeah. So I don't know when we're going to do it, but it'll probably be pretty soon because it's so rare that we do something new that it would be nice to kind of do it while it's still, you know,
relevant.
Yeah.
Right. Although the dirt was relevant. No one gave
I know,
a shit
like
about
totally
that,
by
so.
Totally by accident. Yeah. So we'll be back. I think that's more ideas than we usually have, to be honest.
Yeah.
So. Of course you can find us, you probably already, if you're listening, most people listen to us on YouTube. You can keep doing that, or if you're not, we are on YouTube, and you can leave some nice comments, or leave some comments about how you'd rather blend your balls than listen to us, because honestly, I almost prefer those. And we'll have to do another mailbag episode because we've gotten some good comments lately. You can also find us. You can also find us on you know, various podcast apps. I subscribe to us on Google Podcasts. It shows up there. Google Play shows up there. Stitcher, iTunes.
Apple, yeah. What's the Apple podcast one? That's the one I have.
Yeah, is it called? It's not called iTunes anymore. I think it might
just
be called
Apple podcast. Yes. I don't know. It literally just says podcast on my phone. So
yeah,
the podcast app.
Yeah, and that's been updating,
if
right?
You have an iPhone.
I'm pretty. Okay, so there you go.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, we're on Facebook, Dystopian Dance Party. We're on Twitter, Dystopian Tweets. We're on Instagram, Dystopian Gram. So, I mean,
we're
basically
on everything, but we're not really successful on anything but YouTube. So.
Yeah, I know, which is honestly the platform that I put the least amount of work into, which just goes to show we might pretend that we have control over these things, but it's all, we're all just, you know, twisting in the wind. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back sooner than you might think.
Yeah.